On the show today, we talk to the Toowoomba elders about what actually makes you an elder, the changing landscape in health that they've experienced, what the apology meant for them, and what sort of pressures and challenges they're experiencing within their communities. It was a fantastic interview, and I'd urge you all to have a good listen.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
Hello there, it's Dr. Danielle Arabina, and I'm here today for the Indigenous Health Med Talk with a group of lovely elders from the Toowoomba region. So I'd love to welcome Uncle Colin, Auntie Helen and Uncle Peter. So welcome and welcome to the show. Yes.
Thank you.
So we'll get you to introduce yourselves for me and tell me where you're from. Who's your mob?
Good morning. I'm Auntie Helen Kruger from the Koori mob at Mitchell Way, Thargomindah, and I'm proud to be representing my mob and sitting here helping out the GPs and doctors.
Thank you so much. You want to pass it on to the lovely gents?
Hello, I'm Peter Reynolds. I'm from Cadooga. I'm Murawari tribe, and I've been up in Toowoomba about 18 years now, I think.
18 years, long time. Thank you. And Uncle Colin?
Yes, good morning. My name's Colin Jones. My family background, my grandfather's people were Kalkadoon. We pronounce Kalkadoondi, Mount Isa area, and Nunakalanyugra at Stradbroke Island. So I'm a mixture of those areas and plus a few other ones.
Thank you. Now, aunties and uncles, we've just got a couple of questions that I'd love to ask you that I know that a lot of my GP registrars have asked me before, and one of them particularly is, what makes an elder, and when does society recognise you as an elder?
Well, in traditional culture, young men with initiation didn't become warriors till they were around about 30 years of age, and after they were fully initiated, then they could be brought into the elders. There were some younger elders around the 30 years of age because of their knowledge and wisdom, it says. But usually our older people with knowledge and wisdom of life, we have that expertise in most cases. So that's where elders were. But another interesting thing, it wasn't just men. Women were also respected as elders. So we mustn't forget that. We had women's rights long before Europeans in that structure.
There you go, ahead of our times.
Exactly. And speaking on behalf of the women, you know.
Representing.
Representing, yes. our elders over the age of 50, it's very important to respect our culture and our mob and our warriors. And I think that's where the respect comes in, the aunties and the uncles. And
So can anybody call themselves an elder if you're over the age of 50, for instance?
No, not really, not. No. It's an accepted part of our culture that once you're over 50 that we're elders and we respect the title and to be called auntie and uncle. So
an elder would be somebody who has been accepted by the community where they're living as having specific knowledge and understanding so people can go to them for advice, or is that like a ruler?
Admin or whatever, you know?
So someone who has the knowledge and you
and then I'll be through all the tribal things and
tribal understanding, tribal law and perfect.
Yeah, one of the interesting things when we do our research, in our culture we didn't have kings, queens or chiefs originally. That was done by the Europeans to get the land and put the little brass plaque, King Jackie, King Billy, to put their thumbprints on to make it legal under the Westminster law system. We didn't have that. And so elders were respected for their knowledge and wisdom. And to be an elder, you had to have that knowledge and wisdom and understanding. The other thing is that elders were seen as teachers. We helped the next generation up the ladder with knowledge and wisdom of law, dance, tracking, hunting, bush medicine, weather, the whole structure. They were teachers. They weren't above anyone else. They were to help our people continue on in that line.
So I know that a lot of doctors, you know, might understand that you're an elder in the community. And for instance, if they come in to see you and you come in to see them as a patient, can they, like white fellas, call you auntie and uncle or not?
Well, with me, I don't care.
Uncle Peter doesn't care.
No, I don't know. Well, I appreciate what they say, you know. All right. Everything just goes.
It doesn't really worry me as a rule, but it would be nice to be respected as an auntie and be called auntie. So.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, well, at Kabul Medical Centre there, when I go to the doctors, they refer to me as uncle. And the only thing I think, am I that old already? You know, but no, to me, that has shown respect. I mean, I was brought up as a young child to call anyone older than me auntie or uncle, and now people are calling me uncle. I sort of look behind and think, who are they talking to me?
Yeah.
I forget I'm 72. Come on.
Another doctor and myself were just talking about that. She works, so Dr. Carly Hayward is working in an Aboriginal medical service, and they're all starting to call her auntie. She's like, hang on, not that old. So would it be right to say that maybe any doctor might say, is it okay if I call you auntie or uncle, or would you prefer me to call you auntie or uncle?
Well, from my point of view, I think it's a part of respect for me or our people as a whole, but I think it is nice no matter if they are whatever nationality our doctors are, if they do ask, is it okay if I call you uncle? I think that is also a big sign of respect.
Mm.
And that way, as an uncle, we appreciate that.
Beautiful. So because this is a health podcast, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions like around health-specific questions. And one of the questions I was thinking about coming into here today was, you know, we have those landmark things, that things that happen in the world, and we go, where were you when that happened? Like, where were you when Princess Diana died, for instance? So what were you doing at the time of the Kevin Rudd apology? Do you remember? I was crying in front of the TV after I'd just been to the gym. So that was my, and I'd wagged med school, but no one, but I was probably allowed to do that on that day. Were you with any groups or watching it at home by yourself?
Yeah. I was watching it on TV, that's all.
I remember sitting with my grandmother watching it on TV and just thinking how far we'd come, and it had a pretty deep effect on me.
And how was it for your granny?
She was actually really deeply moved by it, but she felt it was way too late.
Yeah.
For them to be sorry. So.
Yeah, I think I saw it on TV as well, sitting there with my family, and I thought it was a good thing. But the other thing is, because I teach and I lecture, for most, and not being disrespectful, but for most white Australians, they didn't know our history. And a lot of them say, be sorry for what?
Mm.
And it's good that the apology, but to know what the apology is about, because the effect on our grandparents and great-grandparents and so forth was more devastating than on ourselves to an extent. But the recognition, I think, was good, but I still think there's a long way to go within that structure.
Yeah.
I think it's way harder for our elders to accept it rather than our generation. It was much harder for them to accept it from what my grandmother was relaying back to me.
Mm.
Yeah, just on that as well, a lot of our older people and my uncle and so forth, he's passed away now, he said, but do they really understand the feeling of your children being removed and being removed yourself? Sorry is a good thing, but sorry, do they understand what the sorry is about?
Yeah, and I think that that's something that, you know, our doctors or people listening to this really need to understand and comprehend. Why is keeping things like your cultural knowledge, your dreaming stories, understanding, say, traditional bush medicines, why is that important for your health, do you think, or for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's health? Or is it important? All the hard questions here, they're all sitting there going, oh, hey.
No matter what nationality we are, I mean, I do research in South America and Africa, in the Pacific and whatnot. If people do not understand their past and pride in their past, how can they move on with their future with that knowledge and wisdom? And I think it's so important. A lot of our generations in Australia today are trying to trace their family lines back through Europe or wherever it may be, because that's the importance of it. Now, our people very much so, because we are oral visual. Things are handed down. and that oral visual handing down of stories is so important to our people. And if we lose that, we lose the reality of who we are. Even languages, that's played a devastating part, that we've lost so much we can't gain it back. Between 600 and 800 languages and dialects, and I think we got 60 or something left fluently. I mean, that has a devastating effect as well. But we are survivors, we are strong, we can still move on, but we need that knowledge and recognition from our forefathers, where we come from, where we are today, and where we are going. Because our next generation of children, they really need to know where they're going.
Exactly.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. And to pass it down to all our knowledge and what we've learned through our generations, passing it on to the younger generations. And for me, the spiritual side is the best. I just love my spiritual side of my culture.
And what might that be? Could you give us some examples? Like, is it the connection to the earth, or
it's connection to Mother Earth and the water and all that sort of thing for me. And also our bush medicine should come into a big part of it, like the Gumby Gumby and all that sort of a lot of the bush medicine sort of coming back into play now, and I think we can balance it together.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, when I grew up, I used to have a bottle of dugong oil under our cupboard, and it was a bit like the big fat Greek wedding, you know, where they had the Windex. They used to use that all the time as this thing to fix everything. And so we had dugong oil, and so whenever we got sick or had a cough or something, we'd have to have dugong oil. And so I grew up with that sort of stuff. Was that something, did you used to have a traditional medicine, or like the Gumby Gumby, or?
My grandmother used to go and dig up roots from the trees and pulverise them into the poultices on us to draw out impurities.
Yeah.
And that's really stuck with me, and it worked really well, so.
Uncle Peter, I'm looking at you again, Uncle.
Well, like Uncle said, everything was like in the bush, you know, you land all these things and you can't get them out of your mind, you know. But like just smoking. And,
we're not talking about cigarette smoking.
No.
Because that's no good. We can't talk about that on a health show.
You know, like after funerals and that,
yes.
Smoky and just
smoking ceremony
and all that.
Mm. Yeah. And getting rid of the negative energies and spirits.
Spirit and all that, you know.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. And did you have you?
Yeah,
you do smoking all the time.
Kids, yeah, smoke after the funerals and things like that, or anything went wrong, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely.
I've got a very interesting one my grandfather did with me. When you had gastric diarrhea, my grandfather would knock over the termite mounds, the Spinifex termite mounds, the little low ones, and he'd get the inside pulp out of that. And he'd get all the ants out of it, then crush it all up, mix it with water, and we had to drink it.
Mm.
And that worked. It really.
Like a binding or something.
Binded you up, that's for sure. I never forget that. And your breath smelt like termites for the rest of the day. But it did work.
I love all of these sorts of stories. And another elder was talking to me about. Whenever she went back home, she lived in Brisbane, but her mob was from up at Cairns. And she said, whenever she went home, she would go to a particular sacred site, put some of the water onto herself. So I think the concept of us, you know, going back to country, or, you know, as you said, Arnie, connecting to country is something that's really important that I think a lot of doctors don't understand the importance of that spiritual connection to the Great Mother, and how it, like being on the earth and being connected to that can actually be quite healing for us.
Yeah, interesting you said that, because in traditional culture, from my research, the Europeans call it song lines, and they're maps of the land. Like, we didn't sit in one place and eat everything out until there was nothing left and then decided we better move or we're going to starve. That's no way of looking after the environment. And we were natural greenies and ecologists. We looked after the earth, the mother. So the elders, the warriors would come back and say they had a longer distance to go to get the kangaroo, the wallaby, the emu, what it may be. And the women would also report in to get the wild yams and the seeds and the fish and the sand goannas. They were getting a little bit scarcer. So the elders would come together, make a decision, it's time to move and let that earth regenerate. We may not be back there for 6 to 12 months for that earth to regrow again. And that's respect for the earth. Then they would make a decision where to move to within our own area where we belong to. As we went through different areas, there were sacred areas, there was places where childbirth, placenta was buried and so forth. So they would sing of the song of that land where they were. So from the elders down to the little children knew exactly on those song lines. That's why the English called them song lines, not that they understood. We were singing of the path we were going and respect for that land. We knew what happened there. And to get that knowledge and wisdom and pass it on, it is so strong. That's why the understanding of our people, which a lot of Europeans don't understand, our closeness to the earth.
Mm. Yes, that's very true. The water is so healing, and being near the waterfalls and the sea, and gathering up our fresh seafood and clams and what have you, and just, you know, going on walkabout in the bush and connecting to your Mother Earth.
Very important.
Very, very important.
I remember hearing a beautiful story about an Aboriginal woman who had to give birth in the hospital, but she wanted to sort of really bring that spiritual connection to the earth, because traditionally we, you know, went to trees and gave birth straight onto the earth. So what she did is she got a jar of soil from her country plus some water. And in the labour room, she sort of made a bit of a nest with blankets and stuff. And so she gave birth, and she had her aunties and her mother with her. And when the baby was born, they actually rubbed the soil on the bubby and the water. But from a medical point of view as well, I think it's really interesting to do that, because what we're doing is populating their microbiome, so all of the good bacteria in their stomach. So they're almost seeding, like the country is being seeded in the baby, which I thought was beautiful, if we think about it that way. So maybe we should, you know, encourage all of our patients to do that.
Well, that's exactly what koalas do, don't they? They eat their mother's dropping to get all that bacteria the mother and to preserve them. And that's only one.
So what are some of the pressures that are facing our elders today that doctors should be aware of?
Well, everyone has a different idea on these matters, of course. We're all human beings. We all have different ideas and different thoughts. From my point of view, I've raised quite a few children. I think I'm constantly talking to my children and my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, about where we come from, because that's important, because a lot of my grandchildren are becoming lighter and lighter because marrying into a white society. And I lecture on, as our children, we have a recessive gene in our traditional Aboriginal culture, where the only black race you can breed out successfully in 2 to 3 generations is a theory. So we have children going to school who are very light-skinned, and then they get the pressure from the other white children. How can you say you're Aboriginal? You're whiter than me, and so forth, or blue eyes. But, I mean, understanding that recessive gene, where it comes from, and how is a part of the Australian policy for the assimilation breeding out. But to keep the children now, what do we have? We have iPhones, we have computers, we have all the things they like to get in and get involved. And so you start to talk about traditional things to a younger generation, they go, oh, yeah, and pretend they're listening. And you know all the time they're playing a video game in their mind or wherever. So it's a very hard job for elders at present to pass that on. So we've got to be smarter, and we've got to use our wit as well to get them involved, to question them and what would they do in this situation. Do you realise what our grandparents did, your great-grandparents, what they went through? And I use the DVD, Rabbit Proof Fence, with all my children and grandchildren, I have done, and to explain about the breeding out, the running away and what happened and how we were trackers and so forth. And that does get their interest, because they're in the bush, they're doing this and they're escaping from somebody, but the ability and the knowledge to do that, and it's hard today to do that, it really is, but you don't give up. Eventually, when the penny drops, maybe they're 30. And if you're still around, you can still get in there.
Because I think that, regardless of where you go, you know, your bones or the country always calls you back. Like you think you can run away from your culture, but there'll be things that you want to, as you said, like particularly when, I think when you're older and you have your own kids or something, you want to find your centre and your place in the world. And, yeah, country calls you back.
So many of our people are regretful that they didn't get that knowledge from their grandparents.
Yeah.
And finally, as I said, the pennies drop, but sometimes it's a little bit late.
And I think a lot of it's getting lost through the generations, and I feel it's really important to try and reel it back in, and a lot of the old ways are being forgotten, and I think it's really important to try and teach the next generations.
And you're right, it's so hard in a modern world.
In the modern world.
One little thing, if I can say on that too, it's not all our people's fault to an extent, because you go back, like in my grandfather's day, now he was classified as half-caste. Now, on my government files, I'm a light-skinned half-caste getting closer to octoroon. We were graded all the time. But back there, if you were lighter-skinned, you could be accepted in white society if you did not mix with your full-blood relatives, even your full-blood grandmother. The moment you did that, you lost that right. So there was a lot of pressure put on our people to become white, to be accepted, to get ahead. And then we got to think about a lot. I know within my family group, a lot of our older people who were very dark, they give up that right because they wanted their grandchildren and children to get ahead. So they went into denial for that, not for them, it hurt them, but for their children and grandchildren. So when you think about all that denial all the way through, we're the end result of that. Just one example, my mum-in-law, who's now passed away a while ago, quite a while ago, she applied at the Brisbane Hospital for a job in the laundry, because that's all we could ever do, you know. Young girls were domestics, boys were labourers. She applied 7 times, and on her file she had Aboriginal. She got rejected every time. And one of the other ladies who was a friend of hers, and she told us, they keep rejecting me. She said, you've got to be a little bit smarter. They don't like us. Put down Maori. If you're Maori from New Zealand background, you're a little bit above us, so you'll get in. So she put down Maori. She got the job straight away. And she worked there for 15 years. So it's that adaption or adaptability, and we unfortunately lose a lot of our reality to try and survive in that situation.
One of our doctors went to start work in the hospital and they thought she was there to work in the laundry. And she said, no, I'm a doctor.
My son was doing his apprenticeship in Cairns at one of the leading hotels for a chef. And he got the highest marks in Queensland for his apprenticeship. And he was working at the Hilton in Cairns, and 4 of the other chefs there said, Aaron, what's your background? And Aaron said, oh, I'm Aboriginal. And they said, no, you can't be. You wouldn't be. You couldn't do this. You got to be Indian. Mm-hmm. He said, I'll bring my dad and he'll explain.
So you've talked a bit about pressures of carrying on your traditions. What about pressures? I mean, we all know that our health system isn't great for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We know that there is the big health disparity. We're still trying to close the gap. We've got our elders who are dying too young. So would you say that that's a pressure as well, like the health system?
Yes, I think so to a certain degree. We're a lot better funded than we used to be with closing the gap. But, yeah, there probably is a degree of pressure there to some degree that people find, yeah.
What about things like have you experienced racism? As Uncle was saying, you know, sometimes we're skin's getting lighter and we're still identifying as race being Aboriginal. And sometimes that can be like racism in itself because it's, as you said, like you're not the right colour, so how can you be this way? Have you experienced issues with racism or barriers for you to get into accessing health?
No, my children have though. My middle daughter down in Brisbane has, because she's more the white, reddish-haired sort of Indigenous type of person, and she's found it hard to get Indigenous health screening down in Brisbane.
Yeah, I was just thinking, it's like you go to the medical centre, so you go into a new medical centre and a new doctor. A lot of our people are still embarrassed to say that they're Aboriginal background or Torres Strait Islander background because they're light-skinned. And they think, oh, how are they going to believe this? They're not going to believe me. And sometimes the doctors too, they want to find out, and that's why they got the forms to tick if you're Aboriginal or Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander or mixed or whatever. And sometimes they don't know how to approach that as well. And that all comes from a part of from Aboriginal point of view, that we've not been taught this in the education system, what happens. And you go back to 1901 with the White Australia policy, remember the whole thing about no Italians, no Greeks, no Maltese, no Jewish people, no Asian, no black races allowed. Then it goes on a bit further and says the full bloods will die out and the light skins could be bred out to keep Australia pure white stock. So our role in life is to die out or be bred out. We're getting lighter and lighter. And so these things do come up within the health system. But then if you find, and it's up to our people too, we can't sit around with a chip on our shoulder. We've got to be a little bit understanding that this is not taught and explain, yes, I am Aboriginal and my grandfather was this and that and so forth. And straight away, I know I've talked to doctors, you know, myself going to the doctor. And they said, oh, we knew you were something. Are you Maltese or you're Italian descent or are you South African Afrikaans? I mean, I get everything. We're the United Nations. But at the same time, we got to realize they have no knowledge of it. And sometimes our own people do not have the knowledge of it. But it's so important to be accepted in that area because we weren't allowed to go to public hospitals. My wife worked at St. George, and she said any Murray ones come in, they're in a shed down the back. She used to have to look after them. They weren't allowed in the wards, and that's in our lifetime, you know, and things like that. So, yeah, there's still a little bit there, but we have to be a little bit more proactive and speak about it and bring it up and, you know, in a nice way.
As elders, speaking just a little bit more on the pressure, I was just thinking when you're talking, you know, I was particularly interested in, you know, like bringing the ancient ideologies into modern times. And, you know, with our children today, there's, as you said, there's so much pressure on like iPhones and stuff like that. And of course, we've got, you know, communities experiencing issues with drugs and alcohol. So as elders, if you're someone that people turn to for guidance, it must be difficult for you to think, you know, how can we help this generation? Because some people are really lost, I think. And a lot of it is that sort of intergenerational trauma that's come through from, you know, their grandparents. I mean, we've got evidence now of epigenetic changes through the Jewish Holocaust. Like we're able to track people and say that the grandchildren of people who went through the Holocaust have got higher instances of depression and suicide and stuff like that. So as elders, like how do you deal with those sorts of pressures? I'd probably, you know, feel it a lot in my heart. And
well, I think the main thing is like, well, I'm only speaking from my personal knowledge, is I was fortunate I had my grandfather to teach me, and I was the oldest grandson. My grandmother was English background. They came from Stratford-on-Avon in England, my great-great-grandparents in 1854 into Brisbane, and they were the first free settlers, and they were very snobby and whatnot. And my grandfather was sent to work on my grandmother's father's property, and a little spark arose, and they sort of fell in love. The family had a pink fit and sent my grandfather back to the mission and sent my grandmother to Sydney to learn French and Italian. She returned 6 months later, but they were writing to each other. The spark was still there, and they eloped. Now, you couldn't get married back there if you're Aboriginal and one was white, but my grandmother's cousin was a minister with the Methodist Church at Ottawa down near Toogoolawah and Esk, and so he legally married them. So I'm the end result as the oldest grandchild. Well, the family never got over that, you know, and we always got reminded where we come from and how far we could go within the family. And, you know, some places I was not allowed in the yard to play with my cousins because we were not quite the quality, as they said. But these little things play a big part. And that knowledge, we need to impart knowledge onto our children in that area. And any little bit at all, but do it in a positive manner, not a negative manner with you build up a brick wall, there's already a brick wall there, so you've got a double brick wall and you don't get anywhere. You've got to start chipping down the other wall. Mm. But with knowledge, wisdom and honesty, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
I believe it's important to try and break down the barriers with our younger generation, and especially with my three children. I've taught them to acknowledge where they come from and be proud of their heritage and their culture and who they are. Yeah, I just believe that's really important, and to help any other younger people out there try and find their own way with their culture and their heritage. And
So it's almost like finding an anchor in the storm, you know, like the whirlwind that's going across. Like if we can anchor into our culture and our knowledge, then that's something that can keep us steady.
Exactly, and try to keep them connected to their Mother Earth and the spiritual and everything. And I believe that's really important.
Can I just on that, I was listening and thinking, remember our culture too, we're not all, stiff upper lip and whatnot. We survive on humour and wit. We laugh amongst ourselves, which is so important. Today, not enough people laugh amongst themselves. It's always blame game all the time. And my grandfather always taught me to laugh and to, you know, have a joke. And even today, as I was growing up, you know, friends of mine, they were white friends and European friends. They say, oh, when are you going to invite us around for dinner? And I'd say, oh, yeah, we've got plenty of food at present, not just now, maybe in another couple of weeks. And they look at me and think, what are you talking about? I said, well, when we invite you, please bring your own apple. We love roast. I explain two sides of my ancestors. The Polynesian side were cannibals and whatnot. And I said, we got a little bit of refined English, but I said, the other two do take over. So bring your own apple. You'll enjoy. And then we all have a laugh. And it's good to be able to laugh at yourself and not be so, you know, hard.
Exactly, too. And I believe we're a very strong culture and we should be proud of who we are and to be proud warriors and men and women alike and really promote our heritage and be proud of it. So
my lovely panel of elders, would you be able to talk to me about the changes in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health that you've witnessed in, say, the last 10 years?
I believe we've become more accepting of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, and that there's more health services out there acknowledging chronic disease and acknowledging more families and younger generations and tapping into our chronic disease earlier than later.
Yeah, just thinking on that, I use the example, you look at all the old photographs taken in the late 1800s, early 1900s of our people. We became the most researched and photographed and dissected people in the world because we were the theory of the missing link, the oldest inhabitants close related. That's why in 1967 we were still filed under fauna and flora. So we were quite unique to science and all around the world. Now, when you look at all those old photographs of our people, there is not one man or woman with obesity. You look at the most beautiful figures, the women, and carrying the koolaman on their head and the baby on the hip. So we didn't have that problem. And it's documented we had the best teeth in the world. We cleaned our teeth with charcoal. We had the only, that's why we love sweet things, like the sugar bag honey and so forth. But we had the best teeth in the world. And you look at our people today and we got so many problems with obesity. And what is it about? It's the sugar, the flour, all the things that we eat, like everybody eats today. We always got a problem with that area. So we were a healthy race of people. We understood the bush medicines and what to use and constantly walking about and moving around the land. That kept us healthy as well. But when you look around today, you get in the car, you drive down to McDonald's or you go to KFC or now you can get on Uber. So my grandchildren tell me.
They can come to your house.
Yeah, they can come to your house. And so these things do build up. And, of course, alcohol plays a big part with our, you know, dialysis with the kidney and so forth. And that's a big thing that there's not – I don't think there's one of our – we know someone in our family who has got to go on dialysis, you know, maybe more than one, and heart disease and so forth. So originally we didn't get the attention as a race of people because we were seen as disposable and it was going to happen anyway. So that was all a part of what they did. But now – we're being recognised that we are here. They thought we were going to get rid of us by breeding us out and we're going to die out with all the diseases, but we are resilient and we are still here and we're still going on strong and we're getting more and more of our people. Right? Some of us are lighter skin, but we know who we are. But the thing is now with the medical structure, they always say, a lot of my white friends say, but you guys get everything free. You get this and get that. I said, you got to remember, it's only 50 years ago that we were given human status and citizens in our own country. 50 years ago, and I'm 72. Come on. It's in my lifetime and many of our lifetime. And so we've come a long way. And now I always say, well, we're such a unique race of people. Now they realize they don't want to lose us. We're good for tourism, you know, so they've got to keep us alive. But that's not reality. But that's human what we use. But now we can go to the doctor, and a lot of our – we still have people – like I have family coming from Cherbourg to Toowoomba Hospital and they're very hesitant because Toowoomba is the place where you come if you're going to die, you know, and our older people are still going through that. So mentally that's affecting them in that way. But now having our all over Australia, we have our Aboriginal medical centres, I find they are such a benefit to our people. I mean, I'm bragging about Kabul, but I mean, what we got there and what we do there, people feel at ease. And it's so important for a person to walk into a place where it's alien for them to find out what's going to be wrong with them, but to feel at ease where they are. They see other Murray ones looking after them and working there and saying hello. And, you know, it's just, it's a different way of doing things. And straight away, if you're put at ease, you're willing to listen and to accept and see what the doctors have to say. So it plays a big part. I could go on that forever.
And I think you're right, Uncle Colin. Say when I worked as a intern at Redcliffe Hospital, the local Aboriginal people thought they called it Deadcliffe, like you go there to die. And so, you know, for doctors who are wondering, you know, why Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people mightn't be turning up to outpatient appointments and stuff like that, it's because there's a barrier there that, or a belief system that they're really sick and they're going to die. So they're using avoidance. They don't want to go to those sorts of things, or they don't feel comfortable going in there, or they've might have experienced something that made them, you know, feel like really uncomfortable. There might have been someone who was racist towards them, or a family member might have been treated poorly there, and that's why they don't want to go there, because that hospital's racist, even though, you know, it's just namely one person quite often. So I think that's really important.
And I believe focusing on the nutrition is a big beneficial part of the GP's outreach towards referring towards nutrition, eye health, dental and hearing, because a lot of our people have a lot of issues with their hearing. And
And I even think, you know, things that we feel a bit uncomfortable talking about, like around STIs. Mm. So we've got Condo Man and I think Lubilicious, you know, like she's the female counterpart. But using things where you're going out, I know Aboriginal Medical Services will go into high schools and start like doing that sort of preventative healthcare education. I think that's really like breaking down those barriers as well, and having really clear, simple communication is really helpful for our people.
It's really wonderful getting the message out there early rather than later in our children's lives.
But the question is, why do they make them KFC chips so good? They're so tasty.
Remember, we didn't have potatoes. They all come from South America and Peru.
We're obsessed with them. So can you share with me a health experience you had where it felt right, or the doctor got it right? Because this is, you know, something like, so our doctors can take away and go, oh, okay, if I tick these things off, you know, I can help build rapport with my Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander patient. So we talk about things that quite often go wrong in the hospital system, but what's something that you left and you felt, your heart went, oh, that was so good?
Well, I find quite a few experiences with the doctors, my perspective, what I feel. I like to think very humane things. When doctors are open to you and talk to you, relaxed, and they're interested in you, number one. You know, where do you come from? Or, you know, and I see you've put down Aboriginal, and can you tell me a little bit about that? And when an Aboriginal person sees someone who is not Aboriginal who is interested in themselves and where they come from and their family group, straight away you think, this is good. I can open up to this person. And I can talk and tell him what my feelings are and where I feel sick and why and whatever it may be. And I've had that a few times. So now I'm all mouth, so it doesn't matter anymore, you know. But what I'm getting at, well, I'm 72, you've got nothing to prove anymore. But when you're younger growing up, you hesitate and you think, well, what's he asking me these things for? And then you start to realize you unwind. I had the experience just not last night, the night before. My wife is 84. She's 12 years older than me. And we've been married 48 years. She has negative things with hospitals and all this sort of thing. Now she's on these tablets and she's starting to lose her memory. So we constantly fight about tablets, you know, and I'm trying to take control. And she said, remember, I'm 12 years older than you and I'm your elder, so you have respect. And I think, oh my goodness. I said, you take any more than one dose, you'll be bouncing off the walls, you know. Anyway, what happened? We got the lady from Kabul to come out the other night to go through her tablets. And that was so good that she came from Kabul to our place, which was 5:45 at night, and sat down with us and went through and explained everything. My wife sat there and asked questions, and I was there too, so I know what was going on. And I know that when she left and Gloria said to me, she said, well, that was a change. Someone's interested in what I'm doing and what I'm taking. Little things like that, because Gloria remembers when it wasn't wonderful. I mean, she was sent to Ipswich to work in the nunnery the day she turned 13. And her first job was in scrubbing the floor in the morgue with a dead nun. Well, she took off. She was terrified. She got caught, brought back, 3.5 weeks in jail, hair shaved and publicly flogged at 13. So when you grow up with that, that distrust coming through, and that's what we as a people have got to break that down as well. And there are so many other good people out there who are trying to get to understand us, so we've got to appreciate that.
And I found even the healthcare nurses, their trust and understanding of our culture and getting close to us in doing our 715 health checks and asking all really personal questions and why they ask them makes you feel a lot more comfortable and your trust is barriers are broken down. And my psychologist even asking me whether she could call me auntie. That was just such a lovely sign of respect. So for me, that meant a lot, breaking down the barriers.
Thank you. I've just loved this chat so much, and I've learnt, you know, so much already, and I'm hoping that our doctors will be learning so much from you. Have you got any final words around, you know, maybe what your hope is for doctors and how they can help Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clientele?
Just focusing more on the younger generation, mm-hmm. and when they're really saying they're not feeling well, to really take notice and listen to them more, because for my children, from my perspective, with their chronic health illnesses, having heart condition and blood pressure in their 30s and feeling like they weren't being listened to, I think that's really important to tune in a little bit more and just take a little bit more notice.
Beautiful. Mm.
The problems we have today for our younger generation with alcohol and drugs, which plays a big part. I know so many people. I worked in every community in Queensland for a number of years, and I'm still in contact with all our communities and family and friends, and they're all facing that same problem, the younger generation. Mm. I mean, start off with petrol sniffing, which some of it still is going on, petrol sniffing, but then the ice and marijuana that's coming into the communities, and also prescribed medication for the older people. That's getting stolen and used, and that's a big thing too. And coming from the family and telling the children, they think, yeah, yeah, yeah. But also if the doctor's aware of some things, they can bring little things up like that, because coming from a different person, a different perspective can also hit home a bit quicker. The main thing is for the doctors to learn all they can about our culture and our history, because it's not just the health medical side of it, it's the whole life force of it, who we are. And once you get that understanding, you know who we are and what we are and how to communicate. And by doing that, they'll get that communication back as well, which is so important for our people and for all the doctors. Works both ways.
And I'd just like to add, it can have a big influence on our younger people with their mental health later on in life, and now the way they're treated now with the GPs, yeah, it can really have a big influence on how it affects their mental health.
Uncle Peter, did you want to say anything final?
Yeah, well, I find that they're all pretty good, you know, all the doctors and that I go to see and down the medical centres and all that, you know, and they all seem to be pretty good.
Is there anything that you think they could do that's important, Uncle Pete?
Well, I suppose they're trying to help people, you know, but like our younger generation and that, they just don't care or worry about it, right?
So looking after our children and our young ones. And as you mentioned before, the importance of understanding about culture, you know, like the things you used to do as a kid, like the smoking ceremonies.
Yeah, well, we had a wonderful time though. When we was kids, we'd all run around the scrub all the time, you know, and not worrying about school and all that. Only worrying about sports. Yeah, that's all.
So maybe doctors can encourage their patients to get out there and be active and run around in the scrub again.
Yeah, well, like you see on these programs like Landline and all that, they got all these doctors and that go in that bush, you know, and they land and what the Aboriginal eat and all that, the cook and all the bush tucker and all that. Yeah, I reckon it's pretty good.
Yeah, so I think what you're saying is really important. So doctors need to understand the culture. So it might be something where they go and learn about the bush tucker. And I know my registrars, when we do our immersions, they love learning about all the bush medicine and, you know, this leaf would crush up and it's good for your chest. So I think that stuff is really important for us as doctors to understand. You know, the other thing I think doctors really need to understand is that when you've got your patient sitting with you, you're not just treating the person in front of you, you're actually treating their whole family, because you're going to be making changes in that person's life and they're going to go back and share it with their family. And then if they reckon you're an all right doctor, then next minute you're going to get all the mob coming to see you. So I think that sort of stuff's really important.
I thought of when you said that about, because if you go away with a good experience and communication with your doctor, of course, your family going to say, how'd your doctor's visit go? Oh, he was real deadly, that fellow there, because he asked me this and that, and I could talk to him. They said, oh, what's his name? Can we make a book in there? And it does. That's how we are. Okay. But I was just thinking when you're going through that about the mental health and the impact from that. I was doing some research in the late 1800s in Western Australia. They were rounding up the children, the half-caste and full-blood children, into dormitories. And they had about 130 children in the dormitory. And the children were shooting through. We were cutting. We were gone, you know. So they had to keep going out and rounding him up and bring him back, because the point back there was to be Christianized and civilized. And so then we kept running away, the kids, and they were between, I think it was about 8 to about 14 years of age. Anyway, so then they put bars on the windows so they couldn't abscond and run away. And within 1 year, 60% of those children died of a broken heart, mental stress, and everything else. So you imagine that happened to 60% of those children in 1 year. And that's been going on all over Australia. So the doctors are dealing with those problems we have today, and we are still dealing with those problems. But that awareness of communication with your doctor, I think, is so important.
On that note, my dear lovely elders, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. I really appreciate all the wisdom and knowledge you've shared with us. And also thank you so much for giving up your time and coming to join us in the lovely Toowoomba region. Big thank you.
My pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.